This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Spiritual Ground of Education. This is Lecture 7, entitled The Organization of the Waldorf School, given on August 23, 1922. When we speak of organization today, we generally refer to something structured or prearranged. But when speaking of the Waldorf School organization, I do not mean it in this sense. For really, we cannot organize something unless it has a mechanistic nature. One can organize the arrangement of a factory, using ideas to assemble into a whole what one has put into it. The whole exists, and one must accept it as an organism. It must be studied. One must learn how it is arranged as an organization. The Waldorf School is an organism in this sense, of course, but it cannot be organized in the sense of making a program to establish how the school will be run according to sections 1, 2, 3, and so on. As I said, I am fully convinced that if 5 or a dozen people sit down together today, and I say this without irony, they can work out an ideal school plan that cannot be improved upon. People are so intelligent and smart today, establishing paragraphs 1, 2, up to 12, and so on. The only question is, can it be put into practice? And it would soon become clear that whereas people can create lovely programs, when it comes to establishing the school itself, we must deal with a finished organism. Thus this school is made up of a staff of teachers who are not molded out of wax. Section 1 or 5 might state that a teacher shall be such and such, but the staff is not made up of something we can shape like wax. We have to seek out each teacher, and then accept the faculties that come with that individual. Most important, it is necessary to understand what these faculties are. First, we must know whether a person will make a good elementary teacher, or might be better for the upper classes. It is important to understand the teachers as individuals, including their human organism, the nose or the ear, if we really want to accomplish something. It is not a matter of theoretical principles and rules, but a matter of meeting reality as it comes. If teachers could be shaped from wax, we could make programs, but this cannot be done. So the first reality to deal with is the college of teachers, and we must know this intimately. Thus it is a fundamental principle of the organization of the Waldorf School that because I am its director and spiritual advisor, I must know each individual of the College of Teachers intimately. Second is the children. Here we were faced immediately with certain practical difficulties in the Waldorf School, for it was founded in Stuttgart by Emil Molt amid the emotions and impulses of 1918 and 1919, right after the war. It was initially established as a social action. One could see that not much could be done with adults in terms of society. They gained some understanding in Central Europe for a few weeks after the war. After that, they fell back on the views of their various classes. So the idea arose to do something for the next generation. And because Mr. Molt happened to be an industrialist in Stuttgart, we had no need to go from house to house canvassing for children. We received the children of the workers in his factory. Thus, at the beginning, the children we received from Mr. Molt's factory, about 150 of them, were essentially proletarian children. Added to these were almost all the children of anthroposophists in Stuttgart and the neighborhood, so we had about 200 children to work with at the beginning. This situation meant that the school was, for all practical purposes, a school for all classes. For we had a foundation of proletarian children, and the children of anthroposophists were mostly not proletarian, but included every status from the lowest to the highest. Consequently, any class distinctions were ruled out in the school because of its social composition. The goal throughout has been, and will continue to be, to consider only what is universally human. In the Waldorf School, we considered the educational principles, and we make no difference in applying them whether we are dealing with a child of the proletariat or the child of a former Kaiser, supposing one had sought to enter the school. Educational and didactic principles will be all that counts. Thus, from the very beginning, the Waldorf School was considered a general school. But of course this involved certain difficulties, because the habits proletarian children bring into the school are different from those of children from other classes. These contrasts, in fact, turned out to be very beneficial, apart from a few small issues that were handled with little trouble. You can easily imagine what these matters were. They mostly concern habits of life, and often it is not easy to rid children of all they bring with them to the school. But even this is possible, if it is done with goodwill. Nevertheless, many children of the so-called upper classes are unaccustomed to having this or that on them, and they would sometimes carry home something unpleasant, which led their parents to make some unpleasant comments. As I said, here were the children, what I would call the smaller difficulties. A greater difficulty was the fact that the ideal of the Waldorf School is to educate strictly according to knowledge of the human being, giving children week after week whatever their nature requires. To begin with, we set up the Waldorf School as an elementary school for 8 classes, with children from around 7 to about 15 years old. They came at first from all sorts of different schools, and their levels of achievement varied widely. Certainly not always what we would consider appropriate for a child of 8 or 11. So during the first year, we could not count on accomplishing our ideal in education, nor could we simply proceed 1, 2, 3 according to a plan, but had to proceed according to the individual children in each class. Nevertheless, this would have been only a minor problem. The larger problem is this. No method of education, however ideal, should sever a person's connections in life. People are not abstract things to be put through an education and be finished with. A person is the child of particular parents and grows up as the product of a society. Once education is accomplished, a person must enter that society. You see, if you want to educate children of 14 or 15, according to a strict idea, they would probably meet the ideal, but they would lose their way and never find their place in modern life. Consequently, it has never been merely a matter of following an ideal in the Waldorf School. The point is to educate children so that they stay in touch with society as it exists today. There is no point in saying that that society today is bad. Whether good or bad, we simply have to live in it. And this is the point. We have to live in it, and so we must not isolate the children from it. Thus I was confronted with the very difficult task of carrying out an educational ideal without losing contact with modern life. Naturally, the educational authorities considered the methods of other schools as a kind of ideal. True, they always admitted that the ideal is not possible in practice, and that we must simply do our best under the circumstances. Life makes various demands. In practice, however, when we had to deal with them, they considered the existing arrangements set up by the state or other authorities to be the best, and they viewed an institution such as the Waldorf School as a kind of crank hobby, or the whimsy of someone a little touched in the head. You know, it's often possible to just let a crank school like this carry on and see what comes of it. In any case, it has to be dealt with. So I tried to come to terms with them through a compromise. In a memo, I asked them to allow us 3 years to try out my, in quotes, whimsy, at the end of which our school would be advanced enough to enter conventional schools. At the end of which our children would be advanced enough to enter conventional schools. So I worked out a memo. I showed them how, once the children had finished the 3rd elementary class, in their 9th year, they would have reached a certain level, and would be able to enter the 4th grade in another school. In the meantime, however, I said, I wanted complete freedom to give the children, week by week, all that is needed according to a knowledge of the human being. Then I requested freedom again from the 9th to 12th years. At the end of the 12th year, the children would have again reached a level that would enable them to enter an ordinary school. And the same thing was requested in relation to their graduation. It was similar with regard to the children, I mean, of course, the young ladies and gentlemen, who would be leaving school to enter college, university, or another school of higher education. From puberty until the time of entering college, there should be complete freedom. By that time, however, they should be advanced enough to enter any college or university, for it will, of course, be a long time before the free high school at Dornach will be approved for giving a qualification for going into life. This parallel arrangement with conventional schools was an attempt to harmonize our own intent and ideals with the existing situation. There is nothing impractical about our school. On the contrary, this whimsy aims in every way to have a practical application to life. There is no question of establishing the school along the lines of some bad invention. Then it would indeed be a construction, not an organization. Rather, it is truly a matter of studying week by week the organization that exists. Then any observer of human nature, including the nature of children, will actually discover the most concrete pedagogical measures from month to month. A doctor, for example, does not state, during the very first examination, everything that must be done for a patient. A good doctor needs to keep a patient under observation, because the human being is an organism. This is even more true of an organism such as a school, which must become a continued study. After all, it is quite likely that, given the nature of our staff and children, say, in 1920, we will operate in a very different way than we might with our staff and children in 1924. Perhaps the staff will have increased and changed, and we will certainly have different children. Consequently, a neat set of a dozen or so rules would be useless. The experience gained day by day in the classroom is the only thing that matters. The heart of the Waldorf School in terms of organization is the teacher's staff meeting. These meetings are held regularly, and when I can be in Stuttgart, they are held under my guidance, but in other circumstances they are held at frequent intervals. Footnote: for the full record of those meetings from 1919 to 1924, see title Faculty Meetings with Rudolf Steiner, 2 volumes, at the Vesophic Press, 1998. End of footnote. Here, before the assembled staff, all the teachers in the school discuss their classroom experiences in detail. These regular staff meetings have the effect of making the school into an organism, just as the human body is an organism by virtue of its heart. In these staff meetings, it is not the principles that are most important, but the willingness of teachers to live together in goodwill and the avoidance of any form of competition. It is most significant that if one teacher makes a suggestion to another, it helps only when it involves the love of each individual child. And by this I do not mean the kind of love that is usually spoken of, but the love of an artistic teacher. This love has a different nuance than that of ordinary love. It is not like the sympathy we feel for a sick person, although this is a love of humanity. To treat a sick person, and please do not misunderstand me, we must also be able to love the illness. One must be able to speak of a beautiful illness. Of course, for the patient it is very bad, but for the one who has to treat it, it is a beautiful illness. In certain circumstances, it can even be a magnificent illness. It may be very bad indeed for the patient, but for those whose task it is to go into it and treat it lovingly, it can be a magnificent illness. Similarly, there might be a boy who is a complete rascal because of his mischievous ways, but his ways are often extraordinarily interesting, and one can love him very much. For example, we have a very abnormal boy in the Waldorf School, a very interesting case. He has been at the school from the beginning and entered the first class. He would typically run straight at his teacher as soon as his back was turned and hit him. The teacher treated this rascal with extraordinary love and extraordinary interest. He would treat the boy with affection and lead him back to his place, showing no sign of having noticed he had been hit from behind. One can treat this child only by considering his whole background and environment. One must know the parental milieu in which he has grown up, and one must understand his pathology. Then, despite his mischievous ways, one can do something with him, especially if one can love this form of mischief. There is something lovable about a person who is exceptionally mischievous. A teacher has to look at these things in a unique way. It is very important for teachers to develop this special love I am speaking of. Then, in the staff meeting, one can speak to the point, for nothing helps so much in dealing with normal children as having observed abnormal children. Healthy children are relatively difficult to study because their every characteristic is toned down. We cannot easily observe a particular characteristic and how it relates to others. In abnormal children, where one complex predominates, we soon discover a way to treat a particular character complex, even if it involves a pathological treatment. And this experience can then be applied to normal children. This, then, is the organization. Such as it is, it has brought credit to the Waldorf School, insofar as the number of children has increased so rapidly. Whereas we began the school with about 200 children, we now have nearly 700, and they are from every class, so that the school is now organized as a general school in the best sense of the word. In most of the classes, particularly the lower, we have had to arrange parallel classes, because there are too many children for a single class. Thus we have first class A, first class B, and so on. This has, of course, placed increasingly great demands on the school. The whole organization is intended to be conceived out of what life presents, and every new child modifies its nature. With each new member, the organism requires a fresh approach and further study of the human being. The schedule in the Waldorf School places the main lesson in the morning. In winter, it begins at 8 or 8:15, in summer, a little earlier. The special feature of the main lesson is that it eliminates the usual schedule. We have no schedule in the usual sense. Instead, a single subject is taught throughout the first two-hour period in the morning with a break for younger children. The subject is carried on for 4 to 6 weeks and taken to a certain level. After that, another subject takes its place. In the higher classes for children of 11, 12, and 13, instead of classes such as religion from 8 to 9, natural history from 9 to 10, arithmetic from 10 to 11, in other words, instead of being thrown from one thing to another, they have, say, 4 weeks of arithmetic in the morning during October, then 3 weeks of natural history, and so on. It may be argued that children might forget what they learn, because a comprehensive subject taken in this way is hard on the memory. This argument, however, must be answered through economy of instruction and the excellence of the teachers. The subjects are recapitulated only in the final weeks of the school year, when we gather, as it were, this year's work. In this way, children grow right into a subject. The language lesson is for us a conversation lesson, and it is the exception to this arrangement. We begin teaching languages, as far as possible, English and French, in the youngest classes of the school, and children learn to speak these languages from the very beginning. As much as possible, the children also learn the language without the meaning being translated into their own language. Thus the word in the foreign language is connected with the object, not with the word in German. In this way, children learn table afresh in a foreign language. They do not learn the foreign word as a translation of Tisch. Thus they learn to enter right into a language other than their mother tongue, and this becomes especially evident with the younger children. Further, it is our practice to avoid giving the younger children any abstract theoretical grammar. Children do not understand grammar until they are 9 or 10, when they reach an important turning point. I will speak about this change when I deal with the boys and girls of the Waldorf School. Language teaching is usually between 10 and 12 in the morning, This is the time used to teach what lies outside the main lesson in the first part of the morning. Thus, any form of religious instruction also takes place at this time. I will talk more about teaching religion, as well as about moral teaching and discipline, when I deal with the theme of boys and girls in the Waldorf School. For the moment, I wish to emphasize that afternoons are used for singing, music, and eurythmy lessons. We do this so that children may participate as much as possible with their whole being in their education. Teaching and education as a whole appeal all the more to the children's whole being, because it is conceived as a whole in the heart of the teachers' meetings I described. This is especially noticeable when education moves from the domain of soul into the physical world and practical life. The school pays particular attention to this transition into physical and practical life. Thus, we try to make sure the children learn to use their hands more and more. We begin with the way little children handle their toys and games, and we develop this into the more artistic crafts, but still in a way that comes naturally from the children. This is the sort of thing we produce. Rudolf Steiner shows the audience various toys. This is typical of the sixth school year. Many of these things belong more to junior classes, but as I said, we have to make compromises, and we'll be able to reach our ideal only later on. Then, what a child of 11 or 12 can do today, a child of 9 will be able to do. The nature of the practical work is both spontaneous and artistic. The children work with their will on something they choose, not something already set. This leads to handwork or woodwork classes, where children carve and make all sorts of objects that they plan themselves. One discovers how much children can bring forth when their education is based on real life. I will give you an example. We get the children to carve things that will be both artistic and useful. One can put things in this one, for example. Steiner holds up a sample. We get the children to carve forms like this so that they get a feeling for form as it comes from themselves. The children thus make a form derived from their own volition and enjoyment, and this brings out something very remarkable. Suppose we have had a human anatomy class at some time with this group, something particularly important for the sixth class. We explained the shapes of the bones and skeletal system, as well as the outer form of the body and the functions of the human organism. Because the instruction has been given in an artistic form, as I described, the children have been alive to it and have really taken it in. It has reached into their volition and not remained just thoughts in their heads. When they begin to do things like this, a carved bowl, we see that it lives on in their hands. The forms will vary according to what we have been teaching. It comes out in these forms. From the children's sculpting work, we can tell what was done in the morning from 8 to 10, because the instruction permeates the whole being. This is achieved only by truly seeing the way things occur in nature. May I say something very heretical? People are very fond of giving dolls to children, especially pretty dolls. They fail to see that children really don't want this. They wave it away, but it is forced on them. Pretty dolls, all painted. It is far better to give children a handkerchief, or if you can't spare that, a piece of cloth. You tie it together, make the head here, paint the nose, 2 eyes, and so on, Steiner demonstrates with his own handkerchief. Healthy children much prefer to play with these than with the pretty dolls, because something is left to the imagination. The most magnificent doll with red cheeks and such leaves nothing for the imagination to do. The fine doll brings an inner emptiness to a child. Now, how do we draw out of children the things they make? When the children in our sixth class begin to produce things out of their own feeling for form, they look like this, as you can see from this small example, a wooden doll we brought with us. These things are just as they grow from the unique imagination of any child. It is very important, however, to get children to see as early as possible that they wish to think of life as naturally flexible, not innately rigid. Thus, when we get children to create toys, which for them are serious things, we must make sure that the things have mobility. children do something like this entirely on their own. To my mind, a most remarkable fellow, a carved bear. They also attach these strings without any outside suggestion, so that this little fellow can wag his tongue when the string is pulled like this. Children bring their own imagination into play. They make a cat, not just a nice cat, but just as it strikes them. It might be humped without further ado, and very well done. I consider it especially valuable for children to be involved, even in their toys, with things that move, not just static things, but things that can be manipulated. Thus they make things that give them enormous joy in the process. They not only make realistic things, but invent little people like these gnomes and the like. Steiner displays more toys. And children discover how to make more complicated toys, such as this temperament bird. They are not told this can be made, but are encouraged until they make such a lively toy on their own. You can see it looks very depressed and sad. The head and tail of the toy can be moved up and down. They were up at first, and then Steiner moved them down. When children make something like this, a yellow owl with movable wings, they get a wonderful satisfaction. This can be done by children of 10 to 14. So far, only the older children have done this, but eventually we intend to introduce it to the younger classes, and of course the forms will become simpler. In addition to our handicraft teaching, there are other handwork lessons. Keep in mind that boys and girls are always taught together in the Waldorf School, right up to the highest class. So, with some exceptions, of course, the boys learn to do the same things the girls do, although, as we build the higher classes, there will have to be some differentiation. It is remarkable how readily the little boys knit and crochet, while the girls willingly do work usually given just to boys. This has a social effect as well, mutual understanding between the sexes, which is tremendously important today. We still tend to be very unsocial and prejudiced in this matter, so it is very good when we get the results I will describe now. In Dornach we had a small school like this. In the name of Swiss freedom, it is forbidden, and the best we can do is teach the more advanced young ladies and gentlemen, because Swiss freedom prohibits the existence of free schools that compete with state-run schools. Of course, such things are not merely a matter of education. Nevertheless, for a while in Dornach, we tried to run a small school of this nature, in which boys and girls work together. This is a boy's work. It was done in Dornach by a little American boy of about 9, a tea cozy. This is the work of a boy, not a girl. And in a Waldorf school, as I have said, boys and girls work side by side in the handwork lessons. All kinds of things are made in handwork, and they work very well together. In these two pieces of work, for example, two small cloths, unless you look at the detail, you cannot tell whether they were done by a boy or a girl. The upper classes currently include boys and girls of 16 and 17. In these, we teach spinning and weaving as an introduction to practical life, so that they make a connection with real life. And in this one area, we find a striking difference. Boys do not want to spin like the girls, but choose to help them. The girls spin, and the boys wish to assist like attendant knights. So far, this is the only difference we have found. In the spinning lesson, the boys want to serve the girls. Apart from this, we have found that the boys do every kind of handwork. You can see that the goal is to build up the handwork and needlework lesson in connection with what is learned in the painting lesson. And in the painting lesson, children are not taught to draw or make patterns. They learn to work freely and spontaneously with color itself. Therefore, it is very important that children have the right experience of color. The children learn nothing if you allow them to dip their brushes in the little blocks of color in an ordinary paint kit, or use a palette when they paint. Children need to learn how to live with color. They should not paint from a palette or blocks of color, but from a jar or mug containing the color dissolved in water. Then they get a feeling of how one color goes with another and feel the harmony of colors through inner experience. This can prove difficult and inconvenient, and sometimes the classroom does not look its best after a painting lesson, since some children are clumsy and others are not well versed in matters of tidiness. Although this method can be problematic, enormous progress is possible when children find a direct connection with color in this way. They learn to paint from the living nature of color itself, rather than trying to copy something in a naturalistic way. Color and form thus seem to appear on their own on the paper. To begin with, both at the Waldorf School in Stuttgart and in Dornach, the children express their own experience of color when painting by placing one color beside another or by enclosing one color within others. Children go right into color and on their own gradually produce form from color. As you see here, the form arises without any drawing involved from color. Steiner shows one of the paintings by the Dornach children. This is done by the somewhat more advanced children in Dornach, but the little children are taught the same principle in the Waldorf School. Here, for example, we have paintings that represent the painting taught in the Waldorf School. They show attempts to express the experience of color. This is not an attempt to paint an object, but to paint an experience of color. Representational painting comes much later. If they paint objects too early, something of their sense of living reality is lost and replaced by a sense for what is dead. By working like this, when approaching a particular object, it becomes far livelier than it would without this foundation. Children who have already learned to live in color can, for example, make the island of Sicily look like this, and we get a map. Thus, artistic work can be related to teaching geography. Once children have acquired a sense of color harmony in this way, they begin to make various useful objects. They are not drawn first, but the children have acquired a feeling for color, so they will be able to paint or form something like this book cover. The important thing is to arouse in children a real feeling for life, and color and form have the power to lead right into life. Now, sometimes you'll see something terrible, such as when a teacher lets a child decorate a neckband, a waistband, and a dress hem, all of which use the very same pattern. One sees this occasionally. Naturally, to an artistic instinct, it is the most horrible thing in the world. Children must be taught very early that a band designed for the neck has a tendency to open in a downward direction, that a wristband tends both up and down, and that the hem must show an upward direction, away from the bottom. We must not perpetrate the atrocity of teaching children to make a single artistic pattern, regardless of where it will appear on a person. In the same way, one should be aware, when making a book cover, that when a person looks at a book and opens it, there is a difference between top and bottom. Children need to grow into this feeling for space and form. It should penetrate right into their limbs. This way of teaching works far more strongly into the physical organism than any abstract work. Thus, the approach to color leads to making all sorts of useful objects, and in making these, children really come to feel the way colors work together, how forms affect one another, and that the whole has a purpose, and therefore one makes it just so. These details are essential to the vitality of the work. The lesson must be a preparation for life. Among these exhibits, you will find all sorts of interesting things. For example, this one is by a rather young girl. I cannot show everything during this lecture, but I would like to point to the many charming objects we brought from the Waldorf School. You will find two songbooks composed by Mr. Baumann that will show you the sort of songs and music we use. There are also various things produced by one of the girls. Because of the customs inspection, we could not bring a great deal with us besides ourselves, but all these things were formed, as you see here. The children have charming ideas. He's showing modeled monkeys. They capture the life in nature. And these are all carved in wood, showing illustrations of wood carvings. With these maps, you can see how fully children go into life when the principle they begin with is so full of life. You see this very clearly in these maps. First, they have an experience of color, and this is a soul experience. Color experience gives them a soul experience. Here, you see Greece experienced in soul. When children are comfortable with color, they begin to sense that in geography they should paint the island of Crete in a certain color, the coast of Anatolia in another, and so on. Children learn to speak through color, and so a map can be produced from the innermost depths of the soul. Think about the children's experience of the earth when they see it inwardly this way, when they paint Crete or northern Greece this way, and when their feelings correspond with colors such as these. Greece comes alive in the soul of a child. Greece can awaken in a new way from a child's soul. This is how the living reality of the world can become part of a human being. And when you confront these children later with the dry reality of everyday life, they respond in a very different way, because they have had an artistic living experience of color in their simple paintings. They have learned to use its language. The end of Lecture 7.